Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. You can see our blog at kosherscene.wordpress.com. Our guest this evening is someone I first met about 41 years ago in Eretz Yisrael. His name is Martin Davidson. At the time, he was a student at Hebrew University. I was a student at Bar-Ilan University. My job was trying to take pictures of any entertainers I could find in my path. He, at the time, had a group called Avnei HaKotel, made up of fellow foreign students at Hebrew University, a group that was quite successful, brought in Hasidic music and blended in with a modern Israeli tone. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening. I just want to make a slight correction. Although it was 41 years ago for you, for me it was like 18 years ago. So there's a discrepancy in ages.
I guess your memory is much better than mine.
I'm sorry, who is this? Yeah,
hello?
No, that's right. It was many moons ago.
Many
Kiddushei Levona have passed by.
So tell me, how did you form the group Avnei HaKotel?
Well, I had the germ of the idea whilst in yeshiva to blend together, to do a fusion of the Hasidic Hebrew music and put it in a modern setting. I mean, I was born near Liverpool. I grew up with a Mersey sound. And therefore, the fusion of those two things, a modern, modern rhythms, modern sounds, although I don't like the word modern, but it, updated, we'll say.
Temporary,
I think, was taking it to the next level. Much as actually what we know today as the Alter Hasidic music is actually, as my mother taught me, was really an influence of Russian marching songs, Polish drinking songs, and the like.
Right.
So everything draws from its influence.
And Romanian peasant songs.
Absolutely, absolutely. They were sometimes very peasant to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that that's what I wanted to do. And I actually called it Pop Hasidic, because the nursery rhyme, Pop Goes the Weasel, so Pop Goes Hasidic. And that was the name of the first extended play album that we put out. And it was a great struggle, as with all new things. People don't like new things. They welcome it after it's successful, but beforehand, when I went to the Israeli authorities to try and get some help, some exposure, they were saying, no, Hasidic, a pop Hasidic, no, any Hasidic, this is for the Bet HaKnesset, for shul, this is for Zmiris and the table, this is not for the stage. And, people will not like this. And then, of course, when I went to get help from the film community, and Echal Shlomo, I remember, had a department of music to promote Jewish music, they said, no, how can you possibly think to go on stage with a guitar and a kippah? That would be terrible.
Chilul Hashem, right?
totally. So what I did is I just went out with it and said, let the audience decide, let people decide. Too often, it's always managers and agents and brokers who are making the decisions. It shouldn't be. But people should hear. If they don't like it, fair enough. But thank goodness, there was one guy who, funnily enough, on Facebook, I just got a thing from him a week ago, Gedi Livner. He was in charge of the Galei Tzahal hit parade. And through him, I got to the fellow on the other, and he said he heard Eshet Chayil, he loved the song, he loved the idea as well, because of course Eshet Chayil would include women, and he said, go record it, I'll put it into the Pinah LeShiputchem, which was people voted, they sent postcards in to the radio voting, and you always had I think four new songs every week that would either replace songs that were going down the hit parade or whatever, and got into them. Mm-hmm. They reached number one in both the Galei Tzahal and the Kol Yisrael hit parades, and Baruch Hashem, we didn't look back.
Very good. But how long did that last, and what was your next musical adventure?
Well, to spend another couple of minutes actually on this, because it's people, I think what really helped it succeed, apart from the song, was that there was a genuine thing after 67. There was genuine coming together much more of the Frum Olam and the secular Israelis a lot of time. And doing performances does a lot more than what the record would do on, you know, on the radio. A lot of people would come up and say, you know, this awakened something in me. Oh, I remember, you know, from my parents or grandparents, you know, Jewish music. And there was a reawakening, a renaissance of Jewish music. And Jewish music is fortunate that it can borrow from many different styles, whether it's jazz or ballads or flamenco or rock and roll. You know, we grew up in the time of the Beatles, so there was that influence. And when we got to performances, and particularly in Chutz La'aretz, when we started doing shows, it was something that unlike they've ever seen before in the genre of Jewish music. And, for example, we did Sim Shalom, which was actually, Sim Shalom was originally, I took it from a Melitzer, thing. I think it was sung by David Verdiger. And we dressed it up, and I got, at that time we had sound effects of war, and then I came out in army uniform, and we took, and then the song was Sim Shalom. It was a very pretty song. And therefore there was a lot of theatrics and dramatics to it. So unlike other people that went out and sang their songs, we very much dressed up and the performance and the idea, and brought a lot more excitement, hopefully, to it. And it really caught on. How long did it go? Well, it's still going, except today it's an industry. Today it produces 50 to 100 records or CDs now every year, and performances all over the world, and an acceptance like there never was. But those were the early days, and except for Shlomo Carlebach, Oliver Shalom, who was considered, you know, a one-of-a-kind, and in that time, right. And they thought him, well, he's out of the mainstream, you know. But so it really developed, and it changed, and we see it in many different ways, and people have overtaken me already, you know, with new ideas, and that's the way it should be. Music should always be developing, should never be static.
Okay, and by the way, with Rechnitzer's Rejects, how many different tapes did you produce?
Well, Rechnitzer Rejects, we're actually working now, beginning to work on number 10. We wanted to make the minion. There are 9 CDs and tapes out, produced by Samech Music, and the Rechnitz, I think, was probably born out of a frustration about 20 years later, after we started with music, because there was everybody and his brother coming out, and sometimes it was quite amusing. So I think that spurred on, and I got together in a hotel in the Catskills with Seymour Rockoff, who's a genius, and he had some shtick songs. It was very clever with lyrics and ideas. And we conspired together, and we produced number one. I remember talking to Sol Tishner, Oliver Shalom, at the House of Menorah, who were the biggest distributors. And I was trying to explain to him what this album was. And he said, I don't understand, I don't get it, you know. And I said, well, it's humor, like music. I tried to say, you know, like Mickey Katz, if you remember Chaim, Mickey Katz did the marvelous stuff.
Of course.
He did also parodies. And so I was trying to say this is a modern, updated, like Mickey Katz attempt. So he said, look, I'll take 100 albums from you, but I won't be able to give them back if I don't sell any. So I said, you know, okay, fine. I wasn't much of a businessman, obviously. And I went to a Shavuos cruise, and when I came back, it was like 3-4 days later, there was his left 15 messages on the machine. I need more. There's the whole thing. And Bonaparte was a big hit, which broke open Rechnitz. And Baruch Hashem allowed a lot of people to hear the combination of music and humor and parody. And then we had Country Yossi and other shtick people who came out, which was good. Lenny Solomon with Schlockrock and other things. And again, right. That became a... and that was a lot of fun. But Rechnitz allowed me to get not serious, you know, for a time. And I think I enjoyed that as much as anything else.
There was a whole cult of Rechnitz. I remember being in a bookstore years ago, and somebody came in and wanted to know what was the latest tape from the Rechnitzer Rebbe. And she was very, very serious that there had to be a Rechnitzer Rebbe. I mean, she just could not take no for an answer when the store owner told her there is no such thing. It's humor. No, there is a Rechnitzer Rebbe. She insisted it had to be.
Well, I must tell you, to my surprise, that just 2 weeks ago, I read in the Jewish press that there is a Rechnitzer family in Los Angeles. I think once I got a letter to the Jewish press actually complaining that Rechnitzer rejects didn't go together, and they took it personally, whatever. But they were the Rechnitzer family, I think from Los Angeles, were getting married to a Chassidische, the son of a Chassidische Rebbe here in New York, who shall remain nameless to protect him. They were celebrating that. I was debating whether to call them up, but I didn't want to interfere. I mean, you know, I would have interfered the chosen to the chuppah, but I didn't want to interfere any more than that. So that was Rechnitz. And actually, you should know that Rechnitz was born probably 8 years. No, more than that. 20 years before that, because when I was a kid, I remember I went, I got an aliyah, Shabbos Mincha, and I said, Baruch Hu Es Hashem Mvorach, and then I said, the Bracha. And everybody says, Baruch Hu Es Hashem Mvorach, you know, you've got to repeat it. I said, And then afterwards, I came back to the aliyah, so people were saying, no, you forgot to repeat it. I said, no, it's a Rechnitz, it's a Minig. So Rechnitz? Yeah, the Rechnitz Rebbe says, you know, that you're not supposed to repeat. And people say, oh, okay. And everybody accepted it. You know, the moment I said, I made up the thing of Rechnitz, and I suddenly, it unlocked with a key a room of treasures. So I realized in the name of Rechnitz, and Rechnitz a Rebbe, you can do a lot of things. A Rebbe has opened the doors to many things. There was a Professor Oring, also from Los Angeles, I guess they're all from California. He wrote a thesis on Rechnitz and the humor. And he explained to the audience, Rechnitz means the right use, nutzen, to use. Recht is the right use
right.
of things, the way things should be. I found that absolutely fascinating because it never occurred to me when I chose the name.
Now, you mentioned the...
And by the way,
yeah?
So, I'm sorry, Chaim. By the way, you should know that Rechnitz, we have a website, rechnitzerejects.com. Rechnitzerejects, you can find it online. And we have that, and we have a message from the Rebbe and everything else. The motto of Rechnitz is, Tachlis gets you nowhere. So it's a little anti-place.
Now, for a while, you were at the Jewish Press, you were the culture and entertainment editor.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your experience there.
That was great. I had worked in actually at the Jerusalem Post, going a little earlier when I was in Israel after yeshiva. I went to a university, as you mentioned. And actually, I went in one day to the Jerusalem Post and I asked for the Yochanan Baum, was the music critic, and he did classical music. I said, well, what about the modern day music? Look what's happening out there. You know, there's a pop culture going on. I think you should write and review things, concerts and records, and, you know, then. He says, well, I don't know anything about it. So I said, well, get somebody who can. He says, good, I'll get you. I said, but I don't know that much about it. I'm just saying you should. anyway, that's how I became the pop music editor at the Jerusalem Post there. And it was from that, when I came to America, that I joined with the Jewish Press in 1980, I believe. And we mm-hmm. took over an arts and entertainment section together with a gossip column that I used to write every week.
Right.
That was an
Remember
association.
That?
And Jewish Press was the major force media there, and not only did it give me Parnassa, but it was I found it fascinating because I love to write, and I love to
Right.
And in doing that, things developed too, and it also was a helpful medium to get the word out about my music and about Rechnitz and about other things too. I reviewed other concerts and albums and stuff, everything, and restaurants and dining and, you know, and regular things that had Jewish content in the regular world. And it was opened a number of great doors, because being in New York and being an entertainment critic really had fantastic possibilities and got to meet a lot of very, very interesting people. And I think that was the heyday, the height of the Jewish Press, of, you know, what they were developing into pages that had arts and entertainment and travel and health and business, you know, which was made it very eminently readable.
Yes, indeed. I used to enjoy that page very, very much. Now, after that, I see that you also wrote a novel.
Yes. Yes, not many people know, actually. I started to write this a year after 9/11. I always wanted to write a novel, but how do you write a novel? And where do you find the time to be able to get up and write a novel? It's funny because I spoke with a novelist called Jonathan Kellerman. He's a very, very popular top 10 crime novel.
Right, right.
Together with it. He's a Frum boy. I know him from Yeshiva, Kerem B'Yavne. That's where I know him from. And actually, when I finished writing the novel, I said to him, you know, I've just written this novel. I don't know where to go from here, what to do. And his advice to me was, firstly, you're better than 90% of the people who talk about writing, because to actually finish it and do it, only 10% get to do it. But actually, it's taken me over 8 years now just to try and put it into shape. He said one thing, before you give it to a publisher, he said, and I'll give you my agent's number, you can call him, although it may not be any help because you've got to stand, you know, it's got to stand on its own 2 feet, quite rightly. Mm-hmm. But he said, it's got to be so perfect, it's got to be as close to Torah Sinai, which is what he said, as possible after. He said, because don't think afterwards they'll edit it, they'll change it. And anybody out there who's thinking to write a novel and do something like that, you should be forewarned. You've got to make it as absolutely perfect that nothing could be added to it and everything else. And then they'll butcher it and change the whole thing. But that's how you have to present it. And therefore, I've spent all this time and continue to. And I find editing the hardest thing in the world. Because every time I come to a page, even when I've redone it, revamped it, and I think it's perfect, and the next day I come to it just to gloss over it before moving on. And I say, oh, this could be better, this should be done. And it's never ending. And also, when you do 450 pages, you've got to be careful not to repeat and not, you know, a lot of
right.
things.
Right.
And sometimes
so
you're really searching.
How similar is The Curious Lawyer, your novel, to the Alex Delaware series of Kellerman?
Oh, Alex Delaware is his character, is
right.
a very good character. No connection whatsoever. Jonathan, I only contacted after the novel was done. And I wouldn't say there's a leading character, but there is a firm of lawyers. And the only thing I knew, Chaim, starting this book, when I went to the computer to type, was who did it. And a lot of the characters grew to life, I should say, They jumped off the
page. As you were writing.
Yes, yes. It's very strange, because normally I thought the thing to do is plot everything out and then write it out. I didn't do that. I literally let the fingers do the walking. Maybe that's why I'm spending so much time and so many years in refining it. But that's the way I did it. Maybe next time out, you do later. And by the way, Jonathan said also, when you present your novel, you have to tell them that you've got this a second novel already started and give them an opening chapter of the second novel.
Mm.
But
so what is
your
second novel about?
Well, it's going to be a continuation of the characters, the surviving
mm-hmm.
characters, because it is a murder mystery. And that's what I did. And you have to finish every chapter to leave somebody wanting to turn the page.
Of course.
So the trick is page turners. But you know what? It's the meat of it that's the hardest. In other words, okay, you can do these exciting things and put things here and there, but how are you going to keep, sustain people's interest for the rest of the book and in between? And that's the trick, you know? And I'm not sure I know that trick yet, but I'm working hard on it.
Well, I've seen some of your writing, some of your nonfiction writing, and you certainly know how to hold the audience attention.
Well,
I've also
kind.
Seen
well,
you on stage,
I,
and you certainly know how to hold the audience attention.
Well, I tell you, the thing that guided me with performance and stage was, and it's funny because I spoke to Yigal Salek, who was also in London at the time, started Theatre London.
Right,
which was a
right.
Believable thing. And he also was jumping all over and did this and a shtick, had tremendous imagination. And we mm-hmm. said, you know, the way you judge what you should be doing on stage is put yourself in the third row and say, what would I like to see and hear? What would excite me? What would generate interest? And when you do that, as opposed to saying, oh, I've got this great song I want everybody to hear, if you think about your audience first and put them first, you're more likely to succeed, because you're not very different than the many other people who read a book. That's why popular authors are the ones that really get to human interest, and we're all humans, and except for a minority who just are not interested in the genre or the way of writing. But, you know, there's a couple of writers today. One is Harlan Coben, who's a mystery thinker, who has unbelievable humor, he writes. Nelson DeMille, I think, is great. He's got a dry English humor,
yes.
And his mystery is excellent. And my favorite is Jeffrey Archer.
I've read some of his stuff, yes.
Yeah, he did.
Now,
he did
you mentioned Yigal Salek. If I remember right, Yigal Salek, I don't know if he still does, but for quite a while he used to have a boys' choir.
Yes. He was really the beginning, the first of all the choir.
And they would do, as you mentioned, all types of theatrics besides the singing and so on.
100%. And I don't think we were very different in that. If you do a performance on stage, you don't just get up and sing. That you do at a chasana.
Right.
You dress up the songs, you think of props, you do surprises, you use a lighting program. All the shows in America and in Europe, especially that we did with full lighting programs, taking advantage of everything we can do. Sometimes, you know, slides and everything else. So you have to do that. People want to be entertained as opposed to hearing music. Entertainment is a step above, you know, which involves a lot more ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also did some work with Israel's President Moshe Katsav, and then you did some work with the Israel Ministry of Tourism before coming back to the States, or did you do that while you were in the States, you were working with them?
No, actually, I did it in Israel. We went to Israel in 1990, and in 1995, actually as a reaction to Rabin's assassination, Shimon Peres came to power, And at that point, they were silencing everybody, but shh, don't allow them, you know, not allowed to, don't say anything. You know, they were really having a complete monopoly over everything. And, they, you know, it, people, I wasn't the only one, people really started to react from that. It's enough already, you know. I think one of the things I wanted to get involved with politically. I was in 30 years in the music business, so it was time for another interest. And I wanted this time not to be on stage, but behind stage. And I was looking for somebody to hitch to, but somebody who would, you know, move on, have some relevance. So obviously it was Likud. It was Likud or Mavdal or something like that, or Guda. And I found that Likud would be a better thing than a bigger party, than a dominant party, and maybe I could have some influence. And I chose Katsab because his brother actually had arranged one of our English performances. He was a shaliach there, Lior Katsab. And he introduced me to his brother. His brother made an appointment for me at Knesset. And he said to me, so well, how can you help me? I said, I can help you, I think, in helping your image and the things that are most important in elections and in people choosing you. And he said, in what way? I said, look at my tie. The tie I was wearing was a little psychedelic, but it was soft. I said, this is a blend of two things. The tie is strong enough to be noticed and soft enough to be absorbed. That's what you have to be. And he said, start Monday. So we went through the historic 1996 elections, which Peres thought he had it in the bag, and Bibi was elected, and Moshe Katsav was appointed Minister of Tourism. And I got to know them better and the family much more closely. They have a wonderful family, his five brothers, and everybody very close-knit. And then in 2000, I went to him again when he decided to run for president. And that was a completely uphill. No Likud candidate had ever won in the battle for presidency. And I think Ehud Barak would be...
Not only that, but considering he was running against Moshe Peretz, against Shimon Peretz, I mean, he would have been the dark horse by far.
Completely underdog, absolutely. In fact, the Peretz strategy was not to do too many interviews and papers, so he didn't write to equal time. And that's what it was, so he was being denied here than the other. And even if they would write something, they would say, no, you know, because all the media was completely bad Peretz, and everybody was a foregone conclusion. And let me tell you, in the Knesset, in his room, in his lishka, his office, when they were counting up the votes, there was four people in the office. Moshe went into the plenum of the Knesset, and tried to speak, because they're elected by the members of Knesset. So he had 120 votes. And Peretz was strolling down, said, oh, I think we're going to win by 80, you know, 80 votes and everything. And they were supremely confident. And Moshe said to me the day before, I'm confident. I really do. I'm not hope confident, but I'm confident. I spoke to people. Peretz has got more enemies than he cares to think about. There's some people who don't care for me, but they're going to vote for me because they don't want him to get in. As a kachaya, it was such a shock. It was stunning because on the first round of votes, they suddenly found out Katsav had more votes than Peretz. And when that happened, people saw the way things were going. And so the second vote, he got a clear majority. And Katsav's a straight guy.
That's why
and very good. It's unfortunate what he's going.
Is that why Shimon Peretz put a price on your head and you had to run away from Eretz Yisrael?
Yeah, he put a price on my head. I didn't have to run away because the price wasn't that high.
I see.
It was 20 shekels, but it was old shekels, not the new Israeli shekels.
Ah, not even the new ones. Ugh.
Right. In actual fact, I must tell you one strategy I did, is I put all over the from areas a whole thing about a poster about that it was that the Rabbanim had issued the whole thing against Sir Peretz, what have you. It was a joke thing and what have you. And then I was called to an interview on the television because they knew that I was connected. and they said, and I had a journalist from Yeted Ne'eman help me compose it. It was completely made up. And he said, look, he said, there's a thing here that the that some of the Datiyim are against Shimon Peres. So I said, well, that's natural, you know, for what he stands for. He wants to give back everything, and he's liberal. And so he says, look, I can even show you. This was on the streets, and he starts reading the thing we planted. And, of course, I looked duly shocked. I said, where did you see this? Where did you get this and everything else? It just shows you can play television people at their game and win.
Then you came back to the States, and you did quite a bit of marketing and advertising, and you became also, in 2006, you became director of communications of the Royal Wine Corporation.
Yes,
now, basically, your job
correct.
Was to change the Jewish conception of what a kosher wine was. Tell us
I think
a little
you
bit
will
about
see,
that.
I think you will see, Chaim, reviewing what we've spoken about till now, that I love challenges. I don't want to fill a job. I want to do something to change the world a little. I think we all do. And
right.
So going into Kedem Wine and saying, oh, wine is good, wasn't enough. What Kedem needed, and they knew it, and they've been battling for it for many years, was to show people that kosher wine could be as good as any other wine. The kosher part of it didn't particularly affect it. The only person who could probably distinguish between kosher wine and non-kosher wine would be the top critics, you know, maybe. But most people can't. And the truth of the matter is, what was and I always said to people, in fact, there was one big critic, I said to him, do me a favor, do a blind test. Taste the wine against a top other wine. Well, we'll mix them up, or three wines. And I said, if it's no good, then it can show itself to be no good. It doesn't own any rights to be better just because it's kosher. But I think it's outstanding. And gradually, through articles in Wall Street Journal, New York Times, in major newspapers, with Detroit and Miami and Los Angeles Times, and major secular press, as well as the wine magazines like Wine Spectator and Wine and Spirits, and Wine Enthusiast and this, that. The general headline always was, kosher, this is not your Bubby's kosher wine. This is not your grandmother's kosher wine. Kosher wine undertakes a drastic change. The only change that took place was in their minds, because they had a particular image of Malishevitz wine, sweet, syrupy, sticky wine.
Right. For a long time, the joke is, you want your wine to be kosher, throw out half the bottle, fill that half up with sugar, mix it well, you now have kosher wine.
That's right. I even think, Chaim, there was an ad, serious ad, like some 30 years ago, that said, our wine you can cut with a knife.
Right.
It was like unbelievable. That's how solid it was. Yeah, probably, right. But thank God, I think it was 3 years.
We had such a wine. Even in Eretz Yisrael, we had such a wine. Yain Konditon.
Oh, that's right.
It was a very, very thick wine. And I remember our pediatrician used to tell us, whenever the kids don't feel well, give them a little bit of Yain Konditon. Make them very, very sleepy. By the time they woke up, they were okay.
That's right. No choice. That's the only way the body could react. But here, there was, it wasn't just that it was nice wine, but they had, the Herzogs invented, I mean, there's eight generations of winemakers. And these people,
right,
since Czechoslovakia, were making wine. They
right.
knew their trade and their craft. And they were interested mm-hmm. in making Kiddush wine. Of course, you have to appeal to the market. Like we said before, you have to
right.
listen to your audience. But they wanted to bring the
Absolutely.
Audience to a different level. If you ask me, the single most important factor in changing people's minds and trends and the way they deal with wine is when the new generation came out, the present contemporary generation, these are young guys who would go out and have wine with their meal, and not just at Kiddush.
Absolutely. In fact, Levana's restaurant, 30-some years ago, when she opened up that restaurant, that was part of her revolution. She brought
Absolutely.
In, against in the conventional wisdom, she brought in dry wines, and everybody said to her, please, you're going to close the place down. No, nobody's going to drink that. And
right.
Eventually, dry wines became the rigueur. Now, almost every restaurant offers first dry wines and maybe some sweet wines.
Right. And there's some in the middle. I mean, not to say that every sweet wine, shall I tell you something? The best, considered the best wine in the world, which is a Sauternes from France, is actually a sweet wine. It's actually a sweet wine. It doesn't mean to say only dry, but dry is usually very much more sophisticated, you're right.
And
that's the wine drinker's wine. But not to the exclusion of the others, because some of the others, like I say, you know,
my
do have it.
My favorite Sauternes are actually brought into this country by Royal, Chateau Piada and Chateau Giron. Both
Giron is absolutely, yes. That's up there. That must be in the top three.
Yes.
As a wine, I think
absolutely.
Worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, also tremendous revolution was, what was it, the Paris experience or the Paris, where they came to taste wine and they voted this wine the best, believing it to be from France, and then they revealed that it was from California.
California, right.
And that was, you can imagine the faces of the French. I mean, at the best of times, the faces aren't usually smiling, but they were so shocked and everything else. And suddenly, California wines took off. And in actual fact, if you take away the snob value, California produces brilliant wines. And the Herzogs have a vineyard right in the heart of it, in Oxnard, in California. They produce excellent wines.
And we're almost out of time. By the way, you're an excellent guest. There are so many questions I want to ask you. We're going to have to do this again.
Guest is only as good as the interviewer.
No, no, no. The interviewer just guides himself by whatever the interviewee says.
Well, this
I'm
would
only
be
asking questions. You're doing
you
the talking.
Start asking me about my criminal background. So it's very good you stayed off that.
Okay. Do you have any parting words for our audience?
Well, I just say it would be apropos to wish everybody a Shana Tova, sweet, happy, healthy year. We're living in turbulent times, as the recent earthquake and hurricane reminds us. And in terms of music, in terms of expression, because I think that's what I do, whether I'm writing, whether it's music or the written word, it's very important to express yourself, both publicly and privately, because privately, you know, you can change. If you change one soul, one person, you change the world. And I think that's our tachlis here in life, is to change the world a little bit. So when we pass on, we can look back and say, my presence counted for something. And that's for each and every one of us. And I hope, please God, everybody will be, and all your subscribers and listeners should be inscribed for a life of good health and happiness.
Amen. And with that, we're just about finished. Thank you very, very much. Like I said, we'd love to have you again soon.
I look forward.
And good night, one and all. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Please listen in to us next week when our guest will be Paul Ben-Sabbat, the CEO of the Manischewitz Company. And again, Manischewitz today is not your grandmother's Manischewitz. It's a very, very different company. Please tune us in next Wednesday, right here on Black Talk Radio at 8 o'clock in the evening. Thank you very much. Good night, one and all.